This is Breakpoint This Week, a weekly briefing on faith, culture, worldview, and mission with John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview.
Welcome to Breakpoint This Week. You know, Warren Smith, one of the challenges of kind of the recording schedule that you have to keep is that sometimes a story hits just moments or hours after you've already kind of hit your deadline for getting the audio files to the producer to get them to the radio station. And it kind of seems like a big story has landed that has gone untalked about. And that was the case last week with the tragic shooting that took place at two mosques down in Christchurch, New Zealand. And so it just feels like an eternity, really, since it happened. But it would be, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't start our conversation this week on what happened in the world as we look at it from a Christian worldview, if we didn't start with that story. As many people noted, when you compare the population of America to the population of New Zealand, this was an attack on the scale of 9/11.
Yeah, I think that's right. It was a huge story all week long. And as you said, John, two reasons I think that we should cover it in particular, that you and I should talk about it. Number one is because of all the worldview implications and questions that are raised. And number two, you were there. You weren't there when it happened, but you've made a lot of trips to New Zealand. You've got a lot of relationships there. I know this must have hit pretty close to home for you.
Man, I'd count some of my closest friends in the world. I mean, they're kind of like the sort of friends that you don't see, obviously, every day or even every year. But when you get together, they're just really dear friends. It's really some folks that deeply influenced my own understanding of worldview and the relationship of worldview to the scripture. And some of my favorite people are down there as well. And Sarah and I, actually, the last big trip we took when she was pregnant with our oldest, so this would, you know, be 13 and a half years ago, was to New Zealand, and we went to Christchurch. And this was even before the earthquake, which devastated the city just a few years ago. But this is a different level. I mean, look, New Zealand is, first of all, just about 4 million people. Christchurch is one of the larger cities, but you're not talking about a large city because there's just not that many large cities. But you're also talking about a country that even though politics and all that sort of stuff is very, very progressive, they're down at the bottom of the world. And that has really shaped their self-understanding, shaped their culture. You work hard, you play hard, you don't rely really on a whole lot of outside influence. It's a pretty peaceful place, you know, has been noted as well. And I saw this up close and personal. Police officers there rarely carry guns. And that was, by the way, one of the things that I thought made this particular attack most cowardly, is that as the reports came out, the shooter had visited to different countries. Ironically, he himself was an immigrant from Australia and had all these anti-immigrant credos in this rambling 74-page manifesto that he wrote. But there's no question in my mind that having been in New Zealand, as compared to the other places that he had visited, he realized this was literally a sitting duck sort of situation, that he was going to be able to hurt a lot of people, and he certainly did.
Well, you know, John, you mentioned the manifesto. Two things jumped out at me about that manifesto, and I'd be curious about your perspective. Number one is that there really was an attempt in that manifesto, a worldview that came forth, that attempt to demonize people, that attempt to dehumanize people. Any sense of a Christian understanding of the world, that we are all made in the image of God, that we all have inherent human dignity, no matter what race or religion or ethnic background we come from. That idea, that fundamentally Christian idea, was totally lost in this manifesto. And number two, the other thing that struck me is that after you read that manifesto and you understand what I just said and many other things about that manifesto, I don't understand why the mainstream media tended to call this guy a far-right extremist. His views were leftist in many ways, certainly not Christian at all.
No, and in many senses, it was kind of like the buffet of the aggrieved. And we have seen more and more of those types of individuals that really are looking to blame everything wrong in their lives on the other, on this kind of mythical non-white invader. And it just kind of gets out of control. So here's a guy who was really, what he called himself, an eco-fascist. I mean, that's a progressive, you know, kind of ecological disasterism sort of view. But he blamed the immigrant for the ecological crisis, you know, that they were having too many babies and the white world wasn't having enough babies. But you're right. I mean, he mentioned the country that he most respected was communist China. I mean, that's not a far-right thing at all. But it does seem that far too often when something like this happens, the attempt to label the attacker, the shooter, or whatever, whether there's no evidence or whether there's even, in this case, like in this case, evidence to the contrary, to label them far right. There's no question that is beginning to hurt the media's credibility.
You know, John, one of the things that we did this week here at the Colson Center, you did it actually, you interviewed Andrew Walker for our podcast, and he said, among other things, that you could see in that manifesto, or it represented, that manifesto represented a decline in the concept of our shared humanity. And Andrew reminded us that the human heart is bent towards not seeing our neighbor as our fellow man and as a partaker in our common humanity. The heart apart from Christ is driven towards animus and resentment towards those who are not like us. I thought that was really well said, and congrats for sort of teasing that out of Andrew on the podcast. It's really worth listening to.
Well, you're right. In fact, we were going to talk about the Equality Act and that looming specter that's been kind of threatening religious liberty since 2014, but we could not talk about really what had happened in Christchurch at these mosques. And, you know, when you hear these kind of white nationalist, you know, talking points that were articulated in this particular shooter's rambling manifesto, there's always this kind of threat to Western civilization. But here's the irony, is that one of the fundamental principles that's emerged in Western civilization is this idea of a shared humanity, of a shared common dignity. And so by trying to quote-unquote save or protect Western civilization, they're attacking and undermining a principle that has really in many ways made Western civilization what it is. Not that Western civ has always gotten human rights, gotten it right. Not that they've always been consistent across Western history about the value of all human beings, regardless of, you know, race or creed or gender or anything like that. Certainly hasn't. But it is an idea that's emerged, and it's an idea that you don't see across the world. It's an idea that you don't see across cultures that haven't been influenced by Christianity. And of course, that's the idea of jihadism, is that the other is the problem with the world. It's the infidel that needs to be erased. And so this reaction against Muslims makes the same fundamental mistake, that the problem is the other, the invader. And that's why I think a Christian worldview has brought in this idea of a shared common humanity and human dignity and universal human rights and all the things that we take for granted, and these ideas that we have that are infecting Western civilization that's not based on the image of God are going to undermine that and eventually make them, I think, unlivable in the long run. Well, you're listening to Breakpoint this week. I'm John Stonestreet here with Warren Smith. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, everybody, I'm Warren Smith. You know, for 2,000 years, Christianity has been a force for good in the world. But these days, lots of people wonder if it still is. That's why the Colson Center's Wilberforce Weekend is so important. The theme of this year's conference asks the question, is Christianity still good for the world? Now, of course, we think the answer to that question is a resounding yes. And we'll be making the case so you're equipped to make the case with your family and friends. This year's Wilberforce Weekend takes place just outside of Washington, D.C. on May 17, 18, and 19. I'll be sharing the platform with philosopher Dr. John Lennox, author and hip-hop artist Jackie Hill Perry, musician and novelist Andrew Peterson, former Atlanta Fire Chief Kelvin Cochran, Pastor Rick Warren, and many more. To find out more or to register, go to wilberforceweekend.org. I look forward to seeing you there. Welcome back. You're listening to Breakpoint this week. I'm Warren Smith with John Stonestreet. And you know, John, pivoting off of the New Zealand story and moving on to some other news items, so one of the things that happened that was really interesting this week was that the Trump administration issued some new guidelines related to transgenders in the military. You may remember a couple of years ago, President Barack Obama said that transgender people could serve openly in the military. And about 1,000 people, just under 1,000 people, actually took him up on that over the couple of years that it has taken for this new set of policies to come into place. But last week, President Trump said that can no longer be the case. If transgender people are going to be in the military, they have to at least report for duty in the uniform of and using the pronouns of their biological sex.
Well, and what we're hearing is that that's a violent activity. And, you know, that to me is where this debate has gone off the rails. It's an inability to actually articulate that which corresponds to reality, and to do so, you know, then you immediately kind of get shouted down. And so that's the kind of the panicked reaction that we've seen from those, particularly on the left, on this particular issue. It also, I think, though, underscores something that we say often at Breakpoint, which is, yeah, politics is downstream from culture, but elections do matter.
Yep.
And, you know, these are guidelines, and we are all familiar with President Obama's famous guidelines that were issued on a number of occasions in a number of different directions. This, you know, the story you just told being one of them, but also, you know, leveraging Title IX, Title VII federal educational money to force schools to integrate restrooms and so on. And, you know, that also underscores that we're going to be dizzy here until we do some real cultural work and we can come to some level of a cultural consensus on some of these issues. We're just going to go back and forth from one election to another when it comes to these presidential quote unquote guidelines that, you know, essentially executive orders in different clothes.
Well, you know, John, one of the things that struck me about that transgender story in particular was almost a footnote in a lot of the news accounts that I read, but that footnote sounded a little like this, that there have been 994 active duty service members that have been diagnosed with gender dysphoria from 2015 to 2017. And those slightly less than 1,000 people accounted for 30,000 mental health visits. They're taking advantage of the military healthcare system to deal with their gender dysphoria. 30,000 visits from 1,000 people, that's 30 visits per person on average. I can't imagine what a strain, what a burden that must be causing to units and to the healthcare system within the military.
Well, and this is an example of, you know, kind of you can't talk about reality. We're either talking about, you know, 1,000 people, basically 1,000 people using 30 visits to deal specifically with gender dysphoria, or we're talking about something that often doesn't get talked about, which is if gender dysphoria is a mental condition in which, you know, our understanding of ourselves doesn't correlate with reality, much the same as we would talk about eating disorders or those people who are born thinking that they should be disabled, the transabled, I think, is what that group of individuals are called. And we count those as mental disorders. And we also recognize that they often go along with other mental health needs. And that's the conversation you're not allowed to have. I mean, we've kind of preempted the fact that, you know, having a kind of a disassociation of your mind and body is no longer a mental disorder, specifically in this case. It is in every other case, but not in this case. And, you know, of course, you would think that that would go along with other ways in which our mental capacities aren't aligning with reality. But you're just not allowed to have that conversation. And so what do you have? You have a big psychology bill for the military, you know, at the end of the experiment.
You know, John, there's another story that, while we're on the subject of human sexuality, that I thought was super interesting, a story of a study that came out in 2014 by a Columbia University researcher, and it purported to show that the reason that gay people have shorter lives is because of prejudice and bullying. Well, our friend Mark Regnerus at the University of Texas looked at the data and looked at that study and could not replicate the results that said that it was, in fact, bullying that was the cause of these bad health outcomes for gay people. And amazingly, the journal that published the original study retracted the study.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating case because this is a cultural narrative that has just gone unquestioned for a really long time, which is that so-called anti-gay bias increases the likelihood of suicide and actually has real-life harm in the lives of people. This is something that we hear across the board. And I think it's been used to scare an awful lot of parents. I meet these parents who say, you know, my child says that they were born in the wrong body or that they're gay, and I don't want them to kill themselves. What do I do? I don't agree with it, but I don't want them to kill. So that narrative has been deeply embedded. And so this is the study that's often quoted in which, you know, that there's this reason that there's a higher death rate, a higher mortality rate, and it's suicide and overall shorter life expectancy because of the social stigma of, you know, towards gay people and towards transgender people. Well, this specifically had to do with those who identify as gay, and it just wasn't a repeatable study. In fact, not only did Mark Regnerus try to repeat the findings and failed based on the same data set back in 2016, but when he reported it, he got such a negative reaction that the journal that published it you know, tried to replicate the findings. And what they found was they couldn't replicate the findings. And that's why now, you know, 3 years after Mark's, you know, failed attempt to replicate the findings, it's just not a legitimate study, that the bias got ahead of the findings. And that's what we're seeing. And that's what's so tragic here. We're not able to have the real conversation that we need to have. We're not really able to deal with the rising suicide rate among teenagers, including those who identify as LGBT, because you can't cross these ideological lines. And so it's really hampering any sort of redemption, any sort of health efforts, because we're dealing with the wrong data set that's driven fundamentally by ideological concerns and not reality itself.
Yeah, two things struck me about that. One was what you just said, that it, on one level, John, it kind of defies common sense that an era in which there has never been greater tolerance for LGBTQ people would be an era where the suicide rate for those folks are actually going up. And so that, to me, is something that's kind of a fact hiding in plain sight that, as you said, for ideological reasons, no one wants to deal with. The other thing that struck me about that story when I read it was, God bless Mark Regnerus. I mean, here's one guy that is standing up to this academic juggernaut, this sort of this academic orthodoxy, consensus, and at least this time seems to have made a difference.
Well, and he's taking shots. I mean,
yeah.
If anybody wants to know about this, just Google Mark's name. He's at the Austin Institute, University of Texas at Austin, and his career has been the story of courageously standing up on issues of sexuality and getting shot at. I mean, seriously, taking a level of abuse and persecution and career, almost committing career suicide, to be honest. Not because he was wrong, but because he went against the cultural narrative. You know, we've talked here before, Warren, about this kind of theology of getting fired. I mean, when is it right to do the right thing? You know, when you know a wrong result's going to come at you. And I think Mark is almost a poster child for the sort of courage that you need to have to do the right thing, even in the midst of an enormous amount of social pressure. When we talk about kind of the folks who have done this, we often think about the Jack Phillips and the Baronelle Stutzmans of the world. Well, Mark needs to be in that list, I think, as well. And speaking of which, there's a kind of a counter story of a Christian institution that chose to go the other direction. And we'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to Breakpoint This Week. I'm John Stone Street here with Warren Smith. Stay with us.
We invite you to visit Breakpoint.org. While you're at our website, be sure to browse our online Colson Center store of great books and other resources. And you can link up to our social media sites like Facebook and Twitter.
Well, we're back on Breakpoint This Week. I'm John Stone Street here with Warren Smith. And as I said right before the break, we were talking about kind of what it takes to have a level of cultural courage and conviction on some of these really controversial topics. This is not only a requirement for individual Christians, you know, the bakers and the florists and the, you know, the sociologists at the University of Texas. It's also something that institutions are facing, I think, especially Christian colleges. Warren, how many times have we talked on Breakpoint or Breakpoint This Week about the pressures that Christian colleges face? I mean, you know, going back to the Title IX, Title VII stuff, the fairness for all, trying to accommodate to, you know, the between LGBT rights and religious freedom. It's really one of the great, I think, challenges of our day is for Christian colleges to, quote unquote, remain Christian.
Well, you know, John, you're absolutely right. Even those colleges that have kind of explicitly stepped out of all the thousands of colleges in this country and attempted to keep those distinctives plain, the Coalition of Christian Colleges and Universities, CCCU, even among that group, there's been division. And Azusa Pacific is one of those colleges that has been in the news about that this week.
Yeah, it is. The Azusa story is really interesting because there's a difference in Christian institutions based on whether they are institutions for Christians or whether they are Christian institutions that are open to everyone, whether they are historically Christian, whether they are denominationally based. And all these kind of bring a little different dynamic from institution to institution. In the case of Azusa Pacific, they are a distinctly Christian university, Christian mission, statement of faith and requirements for faculty. But you don't have to necessarily profess to be a Christian to be a student. In fact, you don't. And so they're a very big school and so on. And one of the challenges that they faced is a kind of a growing group of students who wanted to start an LGBT group, who wanted to identify as LGBT. Now, the school has long had a statement of sexual conduct. In other words, even though you don't have to be a Christian to be a student, you have to be sexually chaste, given, as it says in their statement of faith, God's design for marriage and God's design for sexuality. And so based on that, students cannot be sexually active. But part of that policy has also included then students could not pursue homosexual romantic relationships. Well, months ago, the Office of Student Life changed that and said it was okay for students to pursue same-sex romantic relationships as long as they were not sexual in behavior. And they announced that. Well, the board reversed it back, and the board said, no way. Like, you, this is an inconsistency. And so the board made that decision, overstepped the Office of Student Life. Now what's happened is the school has reversed the decision as again. Part of that has to do with the resignation out of protest of at least two of the board members because of this kind of the direction, at least according to the resignation, the direction that the university seems to be going. So to be clear, here's the policy, Warren. The policy is no student can be engaged in sexual relations. But they, you know, obviously it's not wrong to have a girlfriend on campus as long as you're not sexually active. And so that same standard now is going to apply to students who identify as LGBT. They are allowed to pursue same-sex romantic relationships as long as they're not sexual in nature. A little confusing?
Yeah, very confusing. I mean, it clarifies nothing in my view. It doesn't hold up the biblical norm of sexuality. Yeah, I don't understand how this can't be considered a real compromise. What about you? I mean, John, do you think this is holding any line at all?
Well, no, I don't think it is. I mean, it's holding a line, but it's not the right line. And it's going to be really confusing. So you're going to allow students to pursue 4 years of a same-sex relationship, but they can't express it. And because of what you say, according to the statement of belief, is the biblical understanding of marriages between a man and a woman, you're leading them to do exactly what you're teaching them is not biblical as soon as they graduate. It's the long obedience in the same direction. That's the first thing. The second thing is, what's this line? I mean, where is the line then? Obviously, and I want to say this carefully, but it's a fact that when we say homosexual love and heterosexual love are the same love, like the popular song says, that's actually not true in any biological sense. Intercourse is actually not possible in a same-sex relationship, and I'll leave it at that. So what then counts as inappropriate behavior according to this standard? Is it okay to hold hands as a same-sex couple? Is it okay to kiss? Or where is this magic line? And look, if the basis of saying a sexual relationship between two members of the same sex is unbiblical because of marriage being defined as between a man and a woman, a romantic relationship would be just as wrong as a sexual relationship in that sense, because it's still the reason you know whether it's something that's appropriate or something that's not appropriate is the way God designed men and women. So it doesn't change the biblical standard one bit. It only adds a level of confusion. And what's going to be okay and what's not going to be okay? You know, this is a big mess. And again, they're allowing students to cultivate. And this is something that I think some folks like Jamie Smith and others have written so clearly about is the, in St. Augustine, is the power of the affection. So you're allowing students to cultivate affections that are going against God's will. And you're allowing them to cultivate those things.
Yeah.
And you're not saying that they're wrong. And you're not leading them towards proper affections. That's not preparing kids for life. That's preparing them for confusion.
Well, that's right. I mean, loving the right things in the right way, you would think would be an important part of what it means to grow up, to be an adult, to sort of take your place in the church and in the world. And, you know, John, I think the moral of the story is this is not just what's happening at Azusa Pacific University. This is happening in colleges, even in Christian colleges all around the country. And, you know, I hate to, you know, pivot to a, okay, what can we do about this? But, you know, we need to pray for this school and for other Christian colleges that they would remain faithful. And we need to be very discerning about where we're sending our kids and where we're sending our money, I think.
Well, there's no question about that. That's why you and I are both big fans of Summit Ministries. And that's if you're going to a Christian college or a non-Christian college. There's just something invaluable about putting kids in kind of a boot camp of ideas and having them wrestle deeply with what they believe and why they believe it. And it's also why we want parents to go deep in their own Christian worldview so that they can have these sorts of conversations. And they know how to talk about these things. Warren, I spent the last couple of weeks working with a lot of grandparents, and grandparents think when it comes to the issue of sexuality, so many Christian grandparents think that they're just talking a foreign language compared to what their children and grandchildren think. Well, how do you prepare for that? That's one of the reasons why we do this program each and every week. That's one of the reasons we do a daily commentary called Breakpoint every day. That's one of the reasons we do the Wilberforce Weekend, and why this year at the Wilberforce Weekend, one of the things we'll be talking about is whether Christianity is still a good idea when it comes to sexuality and sexual minorities. That's why we do the Colson Fellows program, which allows folks who are in a position of influence to go deep in their understanding of Christian worldview. I mean, that's really what all this is about. To learn more about all the things that the Colson Center offers, visit our website, breakpoint.org. And we are taking applications right now for new Colson Fellows to study with us for the next year, to dive deep into Christian worldview and cultural understanding, and to develop a 3-year plan for restorative impact. Visit us at breakpoint.org or colsonfellows.org, and we'll tell you how to find out more about becoming a Colson Fellow. Well, Warren, great conversation. We'll be back again next week. For Warren Smith, I'm John Stone Street. Thanks for joining us on Breakpoint this week.